you know, the whole secret to mathematics is finding problems that you want to think about, that you find interesting, that you fester on. Not like the conventional schooling approach, you try to close them down, you try in fact to open them up.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
Because it goes back to a very able graduate student I had immense respect for in many ways, but particularly as a mother and as a person who just seemed to be able to connect to young children in a way that I just found jaw-dropping, and not least her own children. At the time she was working with me, she had a 4-year-old boy and a 3-year-old girl. I'd done a fair bit of paper folding with her in the context of classes and outside classes, and she said to me, I'd really be interested in seeing whether very young children could do some of this. And I was intrigued and had not had the opportunity to work with very young children previously, so I said, yeah, that would be great. I have no idea. There are definite physiological coordination aspects to origami. So I was interested to see whether very young children, preschoolers, could do some of this stuff. So I chose my models carefully, and she brought her kids in. And they have the usual 3- and 4-year-old squirminess features, but they're beautiful kids, and I'm not going to pretend by any means that they're average in their capabilities or anything, but we spent an hour and a half together. They almost, without exception, were totally absorbed in what they did. We generated a number of quite sort of reputable origami models. They liked it. They've gone on to do work in the area and things, but the one thing that stood out for me was about a third of the way into things, we'd done a couple of models, and very simple models, and the boy was physiologically a little better coordinated than his 3-year-old sister, and so she was a bit slower. She was fine, but it took her a little bit longer. But he frequently, and he was very patient, and she was coming along, but he had finished that step several seconds ahead of her, and he's looking at me, and he's looking at her, and he's sort of smiling, and he just passes a question to me, you know, just as we wait for her to recrease her fold. He looks at me and he says, now we do the symmetry. Now, you know, that to me, I've worked probably with several thousand people now on elementary paper folding and its connection to mathematics. That's probably the most profound, certainly relative to the amount of experience people have had and relative to the amount of education that they've had, that's the most profound mathematical observation that I have ever had. I mean, that strikes absolutely to the heart of that enterprise. And symmetry is the whole secret to so much of mathematics. I once worked with an international group trying to organize education not around disciplines, but around concepts. So you identify finite number of concepts, and then you see, how does this concept surface in music? How does it surface in chemistry? How does it surface in political science? I started with the concept of symmetry and never finished. It's everywhere. It's absolutely fundamental to, you know, and in ways which most non-mathematicians just don't realize in mathematics. And this young boy, 4 years old, these simple models are based on do it from one side, rotate it 180 degrees, do it from the other side. And that had been a feature of the previous two models. And he recognized that now we're going to do the symmetry. Wow. Now, that's probably 5 years ago now. That boy is now 9. And what's happened to him in school is not entirely pretty. You know, I have some sympathy for his teachers, but on the other hand, his parents are both They're not homeschoolers, although I think that may be an option. For me, it's a very good example of no doubt that this young human being just had immense potential. Mm-hmm. Realizing that potential in the school setting has really not been a possibility. And I don't criticize, you know, the mm-hmm. teachers have 27 other kids to deal with and all these sorts of things, but it is, I think, sad in some important mm-hmm. ways. So that was my story. To get satisfaction out of mathematics, you have to put in a lot of effort, and quite a bit of that effort is not highly imaginative, or, you know, it's the equivalent of scales in the piano or bench presses in athletics or whatever, provided that it's being done in the context of a sort of bigger picture. You want to be technically competent to pursue some worthwhile aims. That's fine. When it becomes an end in itself, that's the sort of thing that kills mathematics and turns people off and makes them feel as if they're dumb and so forth. So it's a tricky thing.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
What teaching aids do you use to teach math? There's some terrific mathematical software out there. There's a lot of junk as well, a lot of basically flashcard stuff. The software I'm really excited about, although it is hard to use without a fair bit of support, but there's a category called Dynamic Geometry Software produced by Key Curriculum Press in San Francisco or Berkeley called the Geometer's Sketchpad. The individual behind this is a wonderful young man called Nick Jackiw, J-A-C-K-I-W. That's quite terrific software. In the 80s, there was a lot of enthusiasm for a software package called Logo. The way our consumerist culture goes, it is now seen as being passé, and it was a beautiful language. It was built by a team around a man called Seymour Papert at MIT. I was privileged to be a visiting professor there at Seymour's invitation for a couple of years in the 80s, which was just an amazing experience. Seymour and his colleagues developed a lot of very interesting materials, and it's still around and still being used by a small number of people in very imaginative ways with kids. There is a company in Montreal called Logo Computer Systems Incorporated, LCSI, that markets something which is now called Logo Micro Worlds, I believe. That could be quite a terrific thing for parents to work with their kids. Seymour's book is still very much worth reading, particularly for homeschoolers, by the way. Seymour is a card-carrying MIT genius, wonderful man, very, very difficult from some perspectives, but stunningly brilliant and very, very kind man and very, very, very good with children. His book was called Mindstorms, Children, Computers, and Powerful Ideas, which has, by the way, a chapter on mathematical aesthetics in it, the last chapter, which I suspect isn't read very often, never was, but it was the best-selling book in the field of computers and education for many years, in the 80s at least, and still is worth reading. He went on to write a couple of other books which were not as popular, but I think well worth reading, especially perhaps for homeschoolers. One of them was called The Connected Family. And although Seymour didn't write specifically for homeschoolers, a very high percentage of his ideas could be translated into a homeschooling setting. But, you know, those materials cost you a minimum of $100 a whack and can run you, you know, up to $1,000 or several thousands for class sets. You can do a lot of the same things. The mathematical ideas don't really mind whether they're being implemented, realized in freebies or snazzy kits. Another direction of my research, and this is very much influenced by my time in Africa, where access to some of these razzle-dazzle snazzy tools really was not something that you could even pretend was going to happen in the near future. There's enormous amounts of profound mathematics that can come out of very simple materials. And I find, in some ways, I find that challenge even more interesting. I do almost all my paper folding with recycled paper, by the way. There is origami paper, does exist, it's wonderful, but it's very specialized, it's very expensive, it's not easy to come by. And we have, in this wasteful culture, almost unlimited access to paper, most of which is, in some settings, at least, has only been used on one side, and people turf it out if they're considering themselves enlightened, they throw it into a recycling bin. I'm infamous for being a sort of intellectual bag man, going around and pulling paper out of recycling bins, because it turns out, ironically, that paper that's been photocopied is particularly good for paper folding. When you photocopy it, you're basically cooking it, and so it holds creases especially well. I'll tell you, I think I could scare some folks with graphing calculators by the mathematics that I can get out of recycled paper. So that's my the area that I'm most familiar with. In our throwaway culture, there are just tons of things that you can pull out of recycling bins that can help you teach mathematics, or things that you can buy at the dollar store. Decks of cards, provided you don't have problems of various sorts with those devices, are wonderful for all sorts of probability questions. Toothpicks and plasticine will go a long way towards building a lot of attractive mathematical structure. You can soak peas overnight and stick the toothpicks into them, and when they dry, they provide even better ways of holding these objects together. Counters, buttons, bread bag tags, soap bubbles. What you do is you build a sort of skeleton that you dip into a soap solution, and you get a surface which, because of the way nature works, because of the way mathematics works, happens to have certain properties of minimality, of, you know, no waste. I talked about it from an environmental point of view. You know, on and on it goes.
You're listening to Radio Free School on CFMU 93.3.
Take chances! Make mistakes! Get messy!
You know, Buckminster Fuller, who's another person who fits really nicely into this, folks, you can study together with a lot of nice material on the internet. Early in his career, he used to travel with one of his aluminum trailers full of teaching aids, and he had all these geometric shapes and so forth. In his later years, Fuller used almost none of that. He learned to describe things verbally and to have sort of minimalist resources, and I think it's consistent with what I'm saying in other parts of this conversation, that using very simple materials is really what we want to move toward. There's a wonderful book by some British colleagues of mine. It may still be in print, I'm not sure. There's a great little British publisher called Tarquin, T-A-R-Q-U-I-N, which publishes David Mitchell's book on mathematical origami. It also publishes this book called Starting Points. One of the authors on that is a man called Dick Tata, T-A-H-T-A. And that's a wonderful, it's a tripartite thing: mathematical materials of the simple sort that I've talked about, then ways of mathematical problems, and this is a whole other area that we haven't talked about at all. You know, the whole secret to mathematics is finding problems that you want to think about, that you find interesting, that you fester on. Not like the conventional schooling approach, you try to close them down. You try, in fact, to open them up. What would happen if we didn't look at triangles, but we looked at squares? What would happen if we didn't consider it in two dimensions, we considered it in three dimensions? What if we considered it in four dimensions, and so forth? So if you were mathematically sophisticated, well-educated, according to the new McMaster homeschooling approach, the Higginson-Queens approach, whatever, you might ask yourself, when I use that example that somebody said that 1023 was a prime number, what number might he have meant to write? Could he possibly have just transposed some of those numbers. He has the digit 0, 1, 2, and 3. Well, they're a pretty basic set of numbers to use in some sense. Maybe there's some other prime number that he meant to use, and the typesetter just got it mixed up and, you know, hit this instead of that. Well, there's a whole field of mathematics. There's two comments I'll make here. There's a whole field of mathematics which is built around making sure that that sort of mistake doesn't happen. Now, you'd say to yourself, I never have anything to do with error correcting codes. But in fact, you do, unless you're a very unusual member of this culture. Because if you have a driver's license, if you listen to CDs, if you buy books, you're using, whether you know it or not, error correcting codes all the time. The reason that you don't have sort of the sorts of problems with CDs that you do with vinyl records has partly to do with the mathematics of error correcting code. If you scratch a vinyl record, it's going to be predictable. There's going to be a rhythm around where that awkward noise appears. With CDs, some of that problem has been removed because of the mathematics that underlies it.
Topic and I'll drop it because it gets heavier. Never marry a flurry's a throne. The hell with a royal phone, a microphone will be convenient. I'm never being lean on them folk who gonna soak as they get dope. But a badido pop 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 pop. We making touchdowns because we knock those bust down. So
that's that. I know you dig it when I kick it, baby.
That's that.
Homeschooling is a particularly interesting and I think important venue to consider some of these ideas. When you try to take these ideas into schools, the bureaucracy, the structure, the political dimension, and the fact that that model is essentially an industrial model, which is, you know, fits very snugly, not to say that it isn't the kneecapping mechanism for the continuation of that model of materialist culture. Everything is commodified, everything is put in little boxes, there's a right answer, there's a wrong answer. Where do you learn these things? I mean, as I say, this gets to be very, very, very political. If you want to be a critic of schools, and as I say, I'm ambivalent about that because I have great respect for many people who operate in them, and I think there are some institutions, public education, which have many admirable aspects. Having said that, I think they're often soul-destroying places for children. Sometimes those children are going to not find it easy in other environments, but certainly the sort of hard edges of some schools are not what they need. I'm particularly sensitive to certain kids. Well, it's a reflection of who I know, but you know, you get this sort of professional view of things, and then you get the personal view of things, and your nephew and your friend's your neighbor's child and the children of your students. Often mathematics is presented as if it's a static discipline. You know, there's just bigger and bigger sums to do and calculations, and why, if we have calculators and computers, are people still talking about mathematics? Because surely the, you know, you can do as big a calculation as you want as long as you have a big enough computer. Well, that's, you know, that's again a reflection of this emphasis on the numerical side, the arithmetic side, and in some ways that's not really very interesting, or I suppose it's important, but not from the point of view of either personal satisfaction, social satisfaction, or pushing the discipline further. I think Wolfram's right in saying that sort of field of mathematics has been pretty well plowed. There's lots and lots of other fields out there. How much of math is memory work? It depends on what your conception of mathematics is, and there are conceptions of mathematics which are close to the ones which are implemented in educational settings often, where memory work is a very large component of math. I think that's a stunted version of mathematics. It's not one which I personally am very enthusiastic about. It probably is a version of mathematics which is very useful for other purposes. If you want to produce a population which is compliant, then having people learn how to accept authority, to accept this is the way you do this, don't ask questions about it, memorize it, just do it, then, you know, math is probably quite a good instrument. But I think that's a travesty. It's using your cello to hit home runs with. You know, it's just sad. Having said that, I think there's no conception of mathematics where there isn't a lot of, you know, what do you want to call it, grunt work, labor. Most of the time, people who really are motivated to want to know some mathematics in an authentic way, and in the sense that I would approve of the vision of mathematics they're working toward, they would not see that as laborious. They'd see it as serving a purpose, as leading to an important end, and so they'd be happy to do it. I have access to a staggering range of technological devices which will do calculation for me. I still will often prefer to do calculation in my head or on paper, just because I rather like doing that. Your question about is there an easy way to learn sine, cos, and tan? Specific example, you could have substituted almost anything there. You know, it was reputed that Plato had a sign over the academy that there was no royal road to geometry. And there's probably no royal road to trigonometry either. I think if people were working in the framework of mathematics as the study of pattern, they saw themselves as being animals who had a particular cognitive ability, physiological strength in the form of sensitivity to pattern and rhythm, that things like trigonometric ratios would be a lot easier for kids. Sine, cos, and tan are, there are concepts, there are various ways that you can think about them. One of the weaknesses of contemporary math education is that we tend always to choose one way of presenting things, and then if kids don't see that way, you know, it's the end of the road. Or if they happened, as is the case much more often than we realize, I think, to have an alternative insight which is different from the conventional presentation. We tend to ignore it or to imply that they're wrong or dumb or something, and that's even worse. But there are lots of ways to think about implementing, bringing ideas about regularity in the form of sine, cos, tans, their ratios, their proportions, their graphs. They can be done looking at the movement of a point around a circle. They can be looked at from a sort of tabular point of view. They can be looked at generated these days from calculators and so forth. But they always come out of settings where there is a strong element of periodicity, rhythm. And so I tend to think that they'd be a little easier for kids to understand if they had that background. Ian Stewart, in a recent article, said that a mathematician is a person who sees problems where other people don't see problems. And he went on to consider how you lace your shoes as a mathematical problem. Millions of people lace their shoes every day. Almost none of them, as a percentage, none of them think about that. But Stewart, for some reason, thought about that one day. And there are different ways you can lace your shoes. And they're not totally equivalent. And, you know, why does some versions survive and why do other versions not survive, and are there cultural connections and so forth? So this is the way of looking at the world as being an interesting place to understand, to share the results of that thinking and understanding with other people, to use that understanding to make the world a better place for some other people. You know, these are the things that make life worth living, I think.
You are the sum of all of your parts, squared and then squared again, a walking gestalt, stuffed into a cardigan, the tiniest truths. Turn hands on clocks, hold up your socks, slash waves on docks, disintegrate rocks. Today, the hillside's maroon, it rests brown and ochre, the sky's purple gray like the breath of a smoker, the vibrating hues wiggle your retinas like an insect's antennas. Insect's antennas. It's a song. Tiniest truths resonate tones and
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.